And we'll have to continue that conversation, but there's no doubt it's an ongoing trend, and now we are down to a point where we have a record low birth rate in the U.S., with the women on average having fewer than two children. As was pointed out last hour, though, we have seen enough immigration that we're maintaining and actually growing the U.S. population, but how much longer will that continue, particularly if we continue to see big changes to immigration policies? Thank you both. We'll talk to you coming up here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. Joining us now is Mark Conrad, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. Mark, thanks for joining us here on WWL.
My pleasure.
We have seen dramatic changes in what's going on with particularly college athletes here just recently. And then President Donald Trump signs an executive order prohibiting third-party pay-for-play payments to college athletes. So it raises a lot of questions where we go through an era where college athletes were 100% enforced as amateurs, and the only compensation they could receive was in the form of scholarship money and room and board and costs associated with attending college, to a point now where universities can flat out pay athletes to play in college. A huge change, and it's gone through several kind of iterations, hasn't it?
Oh, indeed it has, and it's going to continue to go through iterations.
What does the future hold? We went through the where we could pay college athletes for their name, image, and likeness, where third parties were the ones funding the amounts of money that college athletes were getting, to now where it's supposed to come directly from those universities and colleges. What does the future hold? What further changes do you expect?
Well, a lot of it is still in the courts, because even though there's been a settlement in one major case, which has opened the door to back payments for NIL for students who were in college in the past, and future actually compensation regarding like a revenue sharing of a certain percentage of the athlete's budget, but still it is not resolve the issue completely, because there's still groups that are challenging certain aspects of the settlement. There's also President Trump's executive order, as you noted, and legislation that is being considered in Congress to deal with this matter too, because it is an uncertain time, and a number of universities and colleges and administrators, you know, may want some guidance in the midst of this rapidly changing professionalization of college sports.
And further muddying the waters is that many of these issues are being handled state by state, in state legislatures trying to determine what should and shouldn't happen. I remember here in Louisiana, the NIL conversation having to happen so that colleges and universities in the state could stay on par in recruiting with other states that had already passed NIL. I know you don't have a crystal ball, and clearly very difficult to know what the courts are going to rule going forward. But God, what difficulties college athletes and universities and colleges are going to have navigating this going forward.
Indeed, and I think it's going to be very general, not just the top programs, which could afford arguably to pay college athletes, but what's going to happen to the mid-majors, what's going to happen with a period of pretty free transfers, which is an issue that's been really underrated, that the prior restrictions on transfer rules, you know, the redshirting rules, meaning that I transfer to another school, but I can't play for a team for a year, have been really knocked out. And many of these rules have been challenged by states, as you pointed out, and by state attorney generals, because they want their schools, whether it's Tennessee, Ohio State, you know, powerhouse schools, LSU, arguably, to say, hey, we want to get some good talent that may be playing at a mid-major. So it's almost like the mid-majors are going to be minor leagues for a high-level elite series of teams, with, you know, 30 big universities handling that. In, of course, the majors, as we considered it, you know, football and basketball, but also could be but gymnastics could be track, could be other sports as well. So you're seeing a very uncertain environment. And as you say, the states have their own laws, mainly regarding NIL, but Congress, in its latest bill it's considering, would want to federalize all of that. And make it more of a national standard, you know, which may have some good points, may have some bad points. But at this point, it is really uncertain if that bill is going to pass as well. And the courts are still busy. You know, President Trump can feel all he wants about whether a student athlete should be paid or not. But the fact of the matter is the courts are going to consider whether they're employees under the labor laws or not. And it's really not going to be his jurisdiction. Arguably, it would be the courts and ultimately Congress if they pass a law. Yeah. Dealing with that.
You raise a couple of other issues there. We'll get to unionization coming up because that's now something that many of these court decisions could impact. But you mentioned the transfer portal, and it does really feel like athletes who feel undervalued at their current university now have the opportunity to pretty much put themselves out there to the highest bidder to see, okay, how much money will you offer me to leave the school where I am now and come play for you, particularly through that transfer portal and now that you do not have to sit out that year?
Well, not quite, because still they can't engage in pay for play. That is one restriction that still is in effect. The president noted that in the executive order, but that's an NCAA policy that is still good. So you can't have an overt situation like I'm going to pay you $100,000 if you go to my school. Having said that, NIL opportunities are there. The possibility of more national exposure is there. So, you know, there are tempting reasons why a very talented college athlete from mid-major school X may want to transfer, you know, to a school with a better known program, a more successful program that are more subtle than an outright pay for play.
Yeah, but we're also seeing second stringers at major universities, at one SEC school going to another SEC school or from one major conference to another, even if they're already at the quote unquote big leagues of college athletics, because they feel like they can either get more time on the field and or more money. So are you going to tell me that really these conversations aren't being had with potential transfers or high school players when they're recruiting them about how much money they're going to make coming to a particular university?
I can't comment on that because I don't know for sure. So I don't want to be in the position of saying, oh, it's definitely the case. What I'm saying is that at least on paper, a pay-for-play scheme is not allowed. You know, what happens behind closed doors, you know, we can surmise.
Yeah, but I mean, we hear now about the universities getting this pot of money. You mentioned LSU, that LSU is going to have however many millions of dollars they're going to get to then divvy up amongst the athletes who are competing for their various teams. An athlete's got to ask the question, how much am I going to get? I understand that there's a gray area still there about how in-depth those conversations can get and how much the guarantee can be for how much money they're going to have. But clearly, athletes have to be considering how much money they're going to make at one school versus another.
Well, they are restricted under the settlement in that case called the House versus NCAA case of getting money from a certain pot. A certain percentage of the budget of the athletic department, which is about $20 million. How it's divided is still a question. So you're right there. And there have been challenges regarding that. Do you give the money equally to sports that are not such big-time sports? Do you give it to women's sports, which generally don't earn the kind of revenues, arguably, and publicity that men's sports do, although that is changing. So that's still not decided, and that's been challenged. So despite this legal settlement, there are at least several lawsuits trying to make heads and tails over exactly what we're going to see in the next couple of years. So judges are going to have a big role in this. Ultimately, Congress can. And then you get to the question of unionization.
Let's hold that conversation. We're going to come back and pick it up there. Talk about, can student athletes unionize? Where is that in the legal processes, as there's been conversations about that as they try to get more power as a labor group? We're talking with Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham and author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, and On the News, Mark Conrad. When we come back, we'll talk about college athletes unionizing. And are we heading for a time when college athletes are going to need a lawyer or an agent or somebody to help them navigate all of this? And are they really student athletes when it's all said and done after this, if they're going to be making millions of dollars, whether it's in direct payments from the university or through NIL or whatever it is? We'll pick up the conversation there after this on WWL. So, Professor Conrad, we were talking about unionization potentially for college athletes. This is so hard to navigate now with it changing so rapidly and so severely. Some college athletes have talked about wanting to unionize so that they have one voice with a labor union speaking for them. Where is that at, both in terms of organizationally and legally?
Well, if you asked me a year ago, I'd say that there would be a path to that approach because you would have had a more sympathetic National Labor Relations Board whose general counsel actually advocated that point of view. There's been a change in administrations, as we know, and the present National Labor Relations Board will most likely not be as sympathetic to that point of view. And these petitions to unionize have been stopped. They've not been appealed. There was one involving Dartmouth. There's one involving USC and some other schools in Southern California. That has pretty much been frozen. So we have not seen that much on the labor board front. The courts are still considering in a couple of cases whether these college athletes could be, quote, employees, which is a first requirement for unionization under other labor laws. And it's been divided. It's not been a one unanimous view. There have been different courts with different points of view. So this could end up in the Supreme Court. Then finally, the legislation being considered by Congress can simply say, we don't consider student athletes employees and cannot unionize. It could do that legislatively and bar that and even limit antitrust laws, antitrust challenges too, which is a somewhat other issue. So it's, again, up in the air at this point, but I don't think that the likelihood immediately of unionization is as strong as it could have been maybe a year ago.
Should college athletes of today, or high school athletes getting ready to enter college, should they have someone that they can talk to who can explain everything to them, advocate for them? Do they need an agent or a lawyer or some kind of advocate? Because it really seems that things change so rapidly and it's just unclear. And the last thing anyone wants to do is break a rule and end up ineligible and undervalue themselves and not get what they think they're worth.
It depends on the athlete. If the athlete is nationally ranked, if the athlete really wants to do and can think he or she can do NIL deals and potentially monetize their image, yes, I'd recommend a lawyer and or an agent that knows what they're doing, that are well aware of the NIL rules, up to date on those rules, as well as giving sound legal advice. If it's somebody who'd say, I just want to be on a team and it's a Division III school and my idea is just to play, you know, probably not. It does depend. And I think to put in perspective, most athletes do not get, college athletes get big NIL deals. The average NIL deal could be some kind of social media deal that involves free clothes or a cut of revenues that could be maybe $1,000 a year. The ones that make the millions are relatively rare in the case of the hundreds of thousands of college athletes that play. You know, and that's something that we want to put in perspective. Not everybody who's going to go and play football in the college is going to rake in millions on an endorsement deal or an ambassador deal, sponsorship deal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's going to be a relative few, whether it's football, basketball, gymnastics, track, what have you. But those are the ones that get the publicity. They certainly should have good lawyers and able advisors.
Yeah, I guess we've been a little we've not been the norm necessarily at LSU when we have a gymnast like Olivia Dunn who's making tens of millions of dollars off of her name, image, and likeness. We've seen LSU football and baseball players also making millions through the NIL and now waiting to see how that all pans out under this new paradigm that's coming into focus.
Exactly. I mean, you know, LSU is one of the powerhouses, and it's a nationally known school. I mean, for you guys down there, you know, you know it more intimately than I do. But having said that, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of colleges and universities, and most of them are not going to be powerhouse athletic schools.
What does the future look like, if you had to guess, best in terms of this whole new idea that we don't really have amateur athletes in college anymore? They are semi-pro, I guess, for lack of a better term. And as we watch the NIL era now transform into the direct payment era, what do you think the future is going to hold?
Uncertain. I really think we're in an area of a few years of more litigation, of different policy questions. The big point is going to be, will Congress pass the SCORE Act and have the president sign it? That would standardize the rules. I'm not saying that would be necessarily good, but it would standardize the rules. But it is a very iffy proposition at this point that that is going to get through, especially getting through the 60-vote majority in the Senate, which apparently it has to do. So that's going to be really tough. The other thing is, what are the courts going to do? There's more litigation coming up in the wake of the House settlement. There's Title IX issues. So it's going to be a uncertain roller coaster.
All right. Well, the one certainty is uncertainty. Professor, anything else you want to share with us before we let you run?
No. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for helping us at least understand how difficult this is to understand and how uncertain the future is. Thank you very much. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. 504-260-1870 is the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Got time to take some of your calls and your texts. Do you think college athletes should be paid for playing in college? Should it only be some athletes? Should it be something that's negotiated during the recruiting? Should it be something that is talked about when you're looking at a transfer? And do you think that it is something that's really not talked about, that when an athlete who feels like they can seriously contribute doesn't ask a coach or an athletic director or a recruiter, how much money am I going to make if I come to your university? Call me and text me now. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll take your calls and read your texts at 504-260-1870. Also, open it up to the previous hour because we had a lot of emotional conversation about the fact that women in the United States are having a record few children. On average, women are having less than 1.6 children each. So it's very rare for a woman to have more than two children anymore in the United States. Many are having none. Some are only having one. Are families being selfish or irresponsible for not replacing themselves on this earth? Or are they being responsible and sensible for not bringing children into the earth if they can't afford to raise them the way they see fit? You know, you can sound off as well about that at 504-260-1870. We're back with your calls and texts after this. Is there really anything such as an amateur athlete anymore? I mean, the Olympians all get paid. College athletes now, at least at a certain level, are getting paid. And there's talk about giving more money to athletes who may or may not be making any money for a university. And at what level should they be paid? And is it fair to pay some and not others? These are really difficult conversations. And I think is kind of the reason why the waters are so muddy and the future is so unclear. Text messages are coming in on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line at 504-260-1870. One person says, all these changes with NIL are crazy and out of control. Another says, I don't think college athletes should be paid at all. That's a difficult conversation, though, because the universities are making stupid money off of these college athletes' talents, abilities, and performances. The networks are making crazy money off of these college athletes. So many products and retailers are making money off of these college athletes. And so I get the argument that they should get some of that revenue, that if it's them playing the games and the money that everybody else is making, why shouldn't they get some of that money? Especially since you consider the vast majority of college athletes are not going to play professionally in any sport. It's only a few when you get down to it. Now, it says, let's talk about how the NFL and others should require a degree or an exhaustion of eligibility. Student athletes, they write, graduate to go to the NFL. You know, that's, I've not heard anyone express real concern about that. And it's kind of weird how the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, they all have different eligibility rules in terms of how much time a athlete has to stay in college before they can go play pro. And I think those are conversations that are absolutely worth and should having and should be had. But at the same time, if you're talking, I mean, these are all talking about massive overhauls of the traditional system, but the emphasis, at least in many of the top college programs, has not been on actually having students earning degrees. Sometimes it happens. Most times when you're talking about the athletes that are going on to play professional sports, there's not an emphasis on making sure they earn a degree. It's making sure that they help the team win first and foremost and at least meet those minimum eligibility requirements. But graduating, earning a degree, has never been one of those eligibility requirements. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. We'll continue this conversation. Also getting a lot of great texts about why women in the United States are having fewer children than ever. But first, we have to welcome in Associate Professor in Media Law at LSU, William Maury. Professor, thank you for joining us here on WWL.
Good morning.
We wanted to talk to you because you are one who has your finger on the pulse of what's going on with media conglomerations and growth and maybe reduction of the total number of media outlets. And after what we saw last week with the FCC approving Skydance and Paramount becoming one company, kind of curious on, you know, is this the beginning of more massive mergers, or are we getting to a point of stabilization where we've got about as many big companies controlling the media as we're going to have?
Oh, I'm sure you can always have fewer companies and more massive operations. I don't know. It's hard to predict right now. I suspect that we'll know in the next couple of years if this is finally kind of reaching its bottom, but I suspect we have more to come in terms of mergers and acquisitions and mega companies. A lot depends, I think, on what the FCC sees itself doing, maybe intervening or not intervening. Sometimes they do, and you have kind of a moment of stability and forced harmony, I guess you could call it. And other times they are hands off and they say, you guys do what you're going to do. But either way, we have fewer choices as consumers, which is not good. It's good to have more options, I think, as American media consumers.
If we look at the history of media, we always know there were three huge television networks in the pre-cable days that then went from three to four-ish. Then we saw the cable growth, and we started to see these new companies emerging through their success in cable. Then we saw the conversations of the broadcasting and the cable companies and the newspaper printers and the radio companies all starting to become joining forces to gain power and market share and revenue and everything else. And how many real, I mean, and then now with the internet and the breakdown in the way people consume media over social media and streaming platforms and everything else, there are, how many companies are there that are real movers and real leaders right now when you look at the media landscape?
There are a few that are doing, you know, good despite all the challenges. You have in D.C., you have Politico and Vox. You also have on the West Coast, in certain cities like Seattle, you have GeekWire, which covers the tech industry up there. And down here, we have a bunch of nonprofit newsrooms that do some good work, like the Illuminator. And there's still 500 or so independent newspaper companies out there that are really multimedia companies with often podcast and vodcast and live coverage of things like high school sports that no one else covers, with the exception perhaps of good local radio like you guys. But in general, you know, there's a moment, I think, where Americans have to decide if they want to support having good local media infrastructure. So we're really at a tipping point, I think, at this moment in time.
Yeah, and if we look at the Skydance Paramount merger, I mean, we're talking also about other major companies. What companies fall under the Skydance Paramount umbrella now?
A lot of companies that make movies. So often you'll see studios that are owned by these folks, and so you'll see I'm pretty sure that they own A24, the horror film franchise. I could be wrong, but there's also a Faith Films franchise that they own. And so everything from, you know, feel good family movies to scary movies, you know, these are going to be owned by the same media corporation, basically. And it's already happened with kids programming. I have two kids, but Disney owns a lot of things, obviously, and they're still really a massive force to reckon with. But generally, you're going to see a bunch of brands owned by the same parent company.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the CBS network is still owned, is a Paramount, now
That's
Skydance
right.
company, CBS Television, CBS Radio, CBS News, and Nickelodeon, MTV. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And it is kind of wild, the diversity of holdings that a lot of these companies have. And then you look at NBC Universal, and they're very similar in how they own many, many media outlets, both streaming, broadcast, radio, television, and so on. Do we get to a point where it gets down to like three major players that own everything?
Maybe. There is still inertia and gravitational force that tends to tear these companies apart after a while. You look back at the AOL Time Warner merger back in the early 2000s, that eventually exploded because it was just too big. So, I mean, there's a limit still what you can do as a company and make money. And then the markets do seem to respond well to competition. After a while, if you don't have any competition, you get lazy. And I think other companies and technologies can disrupt you, and you can lose out on your market share. And then you have, you know, eventually more diversity in ownership and options. That's what we saw with streaming services. They're kind of becoming like cable companies now. My students complain about how they have to basically switch around all their platforms to save some money. Used to be a really cheap option in face of cable, but now they're kind of the big cable of our time. So I can see more disruption and more change in the future that's hard to predict. So it's a wild west out there right now, though. That's definitely the metaphor I use with my students is early wild west days. Like there's not even a sheriff in town right at the moment.
Yeah, and it seems
some volunteers.
Anytime there's something new that starts getting successful, starts growing market share, starts drawing an audience, yeah, starts making money, that one of these big companies immediately makes it an offer it cannot refuse to buy it and bring it under its umbrella.
That's right. You'll see, like, this is not the best example, but when Microsoft bought Skype, they thought they had locked down the future of video conference calls, and then we have a pandemic and you have Zoom, which makes lots of money. And so I think even the smartest companies will buy these other smaller companies and think that they've locked down the future, but suddenly they're shellacked by some other new phenomenon. So it's really interesting to see what happens in a free market.
Yeah, and sometimes they buy them because they want their revenue, and sometimes they buy them because they don't want their competition. You know, when you see Facebook buying Instagram, it's like, well, you know, we don't want to face Instagram as a competitor, so we'll just make them ours, and then we'll have
both. For now, anyway, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, yeah, social media has definitely shown that no one platform lasts all that long. That there's, as soon as your parents start using it, you find something new, and the kids will determine what the new social media platforms are going to be.
That's right. Or they'll be off it entirely, like a bunch of my students, which is sort of funny that now they're just off it. Or they lock it down so only their like best buddies can see it. Sort of like having your MySpace top 8, which I also tease them about. That's still around today. And some of them are back on MySpace, which is super nostalgic for me, but really retro cool for them. So it's hilarious.
You're seeing college students today that are anti-social media?
Oh, yeah. Off all the platforms. They do keep Facebook so their parents can check on them because they're paying for the tuition sometimes. or they'll keep in touch with people. So they do have them, but they just don't use them very much. So kind of like static, I guess, social media presence.
Yeah, and I think it's also in some cases so that when their parents and their aunts and their whoever asks them, what's going on in your life? Well, just check my Facebook and you'll see what's going
on
with me.
Here's my newsletter.
But they don't put anything terribly important on there that they don't want their parents and others to know. Professor, anything else as we watch more of this consolidation with massive companies joining forces and trying to control the distribution of media in the United States and around the world that we should talk about?
Oh, I just would urge your listeners to support and subscribe and invest in good media that they like and that is independent and local, ideally, or at least regional. And that way, you know, they still have some flex as consumers if they want to use that muscle and support things that are good, like local radio and local TV and local news.
All right. Well, we sure appreciate that plug. And thank you for joining us here on WWL. Go take care of those kids.
I will. Thanks, Dave.
All right.
Good week.
Thank you. Professor William Murray here on WWL. All right. We're going to have a few minutes before we get Newell Norman in here. I'm going to read some more of your text coming up next. Some people have really interesting thoughts about women having fewer children than ever. You can sound off on what we were just talking about. Do you fear that corporate massive multi-billion-dollar worldwide corporations are controlling too much of the media message and own too much? Or is it better for us as consumers if we have these big companies producing media? I'll tell you this. I know the one thing that does not last is low prices of anything. Anything that is successful at a low price seems like it's eaten up by one of these big companies, and then the rates go up and up and up. We're back to talk about that, the birth rate in America, anything else you want to talk about for a few minutes before we have to make way for Newell Norman on WWL.